You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 3rd to the 9th of April 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter David Matthews, deputy features editor Paul Jump, writer Matthew Rice and editor John Gill. An eminent sociologist has been accused of copying passages from Wikipedia and pasting them into his latest book. 88-year-old Zygmunt Bauman defends himself against this plagiarism accusation in this week's lead news story. More on that in a second. Are we giving prospective students too much data about universities and degree courses, making it more difficult for them to choose where to apply? Some more on that from David shortly. The cover story this week is our annual Vice-Chancellor pay survey, always a hot topic. John will fill us in a bit more on that. And we've already mentioned an octogenarian making the news this week. Matthew visited Newcastle to meet a nonagenarian, Mary Midgley. He's been discussing her latest book, Are You an Illusion? But first, Paul, the lead news story this week pits a Cambridge PhD student against an eminent Leeds University scholar. What's been going on?
Former Leeds, yes. He's emeritus
Emeritus
now.
But yeah.
There is a sort of element of David and Goliath about this. I should just say, actually, that the accusation isn't just that he plagiarised from Wikipedia, but from quite a few websites.
Mm.
But the claim is that his latest book, which is called Does the Richness of the Few Benefit Us All, contains about 8 or 9 examples of passages that are not clear, at least not clearly indicated, have come from these websites. In some cases, the website is sort of mentioned in passing in the text, but it's not, there's no quotation marks around the specific passages.
Mm.
So, yeah, this PhD student has spoken up about this and says it's sort of, a betrayal of scholarly values. And although he very much admires Bauman, he felt sort of obliged to speak out in defence of academic values.
His name's Peter Walsh.
His name's Peter
University
Walsh,
of Cambridge, yeah.
PhD student. And, Bauman, I put this to Bauman, and his response was quite interesting. He said, he essentially said that, the student's essentially being pedantic, and that good scholarship is more about good ideas and that kind of thing, and sort of obsessing over the details of referencing in that way is just sort of being pedantic. And he said he pities the student for, getting his knickers in a twist about it.
That's an extraordinary line, that, isn't it? As his co-worker in the service of knowledge, I can only pity him as a response to a quite serious allegation.
Yes,
it's fairly unique.
Yes, it's a robust response, isn't it? And, I'm sure lots of people have views on whether that's, a reasonable position to take. I mean, you sort of see his point in a way, there is more to worry about than putting quotation marks around the right bit. On the other hand, you can imagine if a PhD student accused of plagiarism came along to their dean and with a similar argument, I don't think they'd get very far. So.
And you do also have the point in the story from the PhD student that he's, to a certain extent risking his neck by even coming out and making the allegation, insofar as, he says that, Bauman is an old school intellectual who he's very had an incredibly impressive career and who he has a lot of respect for as a scholar, but he's also of course somebody who will have a lot of supporters who may look dimly on a young whippersnapper coming out and making suggestions such as this. So it's another interesting element to the piece.
You should of course credit where you get your information from, but it does raise the question, once you get to that age and that notoriety, what you're writing is coming from a position of great experience, and
I'm not sure notoriety is the
fair enough. It's an interesting one. Page 6 for the full lowdown on that one. David, you've been covering this week the story that students might be getting a little bit confused, getting too bombarded with information, prospective students, when they're choosing university. The 2011 white paper, of course, said expanding information to students was key. This research suggests maybe it's not so important.
Yeah. So this is a report that's just been released. It was commissioned by Higher Education Funding Council for England, and it basically goes through a sort of literal review of things like behavioural economics and so on. And it comes to the conclusion, when you give students loads of information about their university choice, you know, kind of graduate employability, you know, teaching hours, all that kind of thing, this can actually lead to decision paralysis, because they're sort of, they have to take in so much information, there's so much out there, that they actually just filter some of it out as a kind of mental coping strategy. And so actually they might make poorer decisions. They actually, you know, the university they choose might actually not be the right one, because they're not actually considering all the information. Mm. Now, I mean, as you say, the background to this is actually the government's been very keen on increasing the amount of information available to students. We've got the revamped Unistats website, where you can go online and see course costs, you know, how you're going to be taught, how much time you spend in lectures, you know, prospective salaries, that kind of thing. And I guess this raises pretty big questions about that. And actually it raises quite big questions about the whole, you know, whether you can actually turn higher education into a market, because that is kind of what the government's trying to do. You know, you as a student, you pay for your course, you get all the information, you make the right decision. But actually, surprisingly, kind of depressingly, this may not be the case.
I think it's interesting, this, isn't it? Every other aspect of the higher education reforms has unravelled, and now the bit about students needing more information appears to be unravelling too. But I think one of the things that was always said about this idea that student needs vast amounts of information is that actually you're misunderstanding how choices are made about things like what universities to study at and what degree to do. And the example the classic example that was given was, you know, if you want to buy a new boiler, you do go out and you look at all the technical figures and stats behind every different type of, you know, combi boiler, whatever else to pick it. But that's not really how choosing a university degree works. And 9 times out of 10, when it comes down to it, it will be based on choices such as, you know, where your parents went, where your friends went, the discussions that happen around the family dinner table, as much as these sort of statistical websites that have cropped up. Yeah. I think the other thing is our experience at THE with the university rankings and the phenomenal and largely unforeseen success of them. I think when they first launched, you know, a decade or so ago, there was, you know, no one really dreamed they'd be as influential as they are now. And without getting into the, you know, pros and cons of that, I think what you find is that students, especially internationally maybe, but I don't see why they shouldn't, you know, work domestically too, like a hierarchical 1 to 100 list. This is,
it's simple,
you know,
isn't it?
It's simple.
It simplifies things. Yeah.
You know, that's the criticism too. It oversimplifies things, and you know, it's a very crude measure, and we understand that. But actually, from a consumer, if I put it like that, point of view, that largely seems to be what a lot of people want.
Yeah, you're describing sort of a traditional student there, though, sort of an 18-year-old going to university for the first time, maybe those discussions around the dinner table. Does this report, is it targeting that particular group? Does it going to go into mature students would put a little bit more weight
it doesn't really go into differences between different types of students, to be honest, but it does talk a lot about how people's university choice is basically constrained or expanded by, you know, their school, you know, what people talk about at school, their you know, friends, their family. So right, it's, you know, if you're from, I think it does say also from a lower socioeconomic background, you do less research. So in fact, your horizons are slightly narrowed, perhaps, and that's deeply troubling.
The one stat that might blow all this out of the water would be if there was ever very accurate, detailed graduate salary information by course, which I know a lot of vice chancellors and admissions officers would view that with horror, and probably rightly so, because then you could end up with a very reductive decision making process. Yeah. But you could envisage that being very influential potentially. But
it would be incredibly influential. I suppose the ethical dilemma about this is you might confuse students by giving them loads of information. But does that mean that you shouldn't give them information? This is the problem. I mean, you know, we might be irrational consumers of university courses and many things, but it's surely you're entitled to that as much information as possible anyway, and you can't really hide it away.
Indeed, yes. Now, page 9 for the lowdown on that. We might not be able to tell a particular course salary implications, but we do know to a fair degree of accuracy what vice chancellors get paid. That's this week's cover feature, our annual VC pay survey. It's big news this year, isn't it? We've had quite a few stories in the build up to the publication of this table. John, I mean, it always makes waves, doesn't it? It's a very emotive issue.
Yeah, I mean,
issue.
We've done this comprehensive analysis, which we do with the accountancy firm Grant Thornton for many years now. And I think over that time, it's become a story that other people have picked up on. And certainly this year, I think there's been more national press interest than I can remember. Mm. It's really been a, as opposed to some previous years, perhaps it was 1 week of pain for vice chancellors when suddenly there was a flare up of interest. I think there's been months where this has bubbled along and appeared in different stories. And I think that can be really damaging for vice chancellors as a group. You know, even those that perhaps haven't taken immodest rises do take some collateral damage from the outliers who, you know, in some cases you can just look at it and any normal, you know, struggling, bright thinking person, put it like that, looks at it and thinks, really? You know, is this in keeping with the spirit of the times? Are vice chancellors really, have they been keeping tabs on the incredible public anger about, you know, some of the executive pay that's gone on in other sectors?
And the strikes, of course, within the HE sector.
There's been a series of below inflation pay rises. There's been, you know, students being asked to take on much more debt than they ever did before. I mean, it just isn't in keeping. And okay, 400,000, say, take a salary of 400,000, which is the sort of top end of the range. Okay, that's a drop in the ocean in the big scheme of, you know, the amount of money that flows through university, but that's really not the point, I don't think. And I've had more than one vice chancellor say to me privately that they're really quite angry about some of the outlying salary hikes, because it damages their credibility as sort of ambassadors for their university and for the sector in general. But yeah, I mean, we've got all the data there, so if you want to find out how much your vice chancellor was paid, pension, there's lots of other things that have been going on for the last couple of years too in there. So you've got these sort of salary to pension flipping, where people sort of max out their pension pots and the money's moved around between those. There's things like, you know, very generous relocation packages, which seems to be money to help you move house. I didn't get that last time I moved house. Did anyone?
No, me neither. No, I don't remember.
I just packed a van and got a couple of Polish guys to help me move house. And, but it's always a big story, always interesting. And I think there is, what the point we've tried to look at this year to try and dig behind this a little bit is looking at the remuneration committees that actually are responsible for deciding what these sums should be. And what comes out of that is that they're very heavily stacked with figures from private business, where probably it is true that actually, you know, even salaries in the magnitude that some of these vice chancellors are earning wouldn't necessarily attract the top talent. But I have my doubts about whether vice chancellors are really as price sensitive as these committees seem to believe.
Hmm. I mean, how many vice chancellors have you heard of who've left to go and take a much higher salary position at a FTSE 100 company?
Well, quite.
Doesn't happen, does it?
Made a success of it. Yeah.
Well, exactly. It's not a market in the sense that they seem to be implying. Hmm.
Yeah, well, that's all analysed for you from page 34, I think, this week. Jack Grove isn't with us. He writes that feature, though, and very informative it is, too. The second feature, to finish off this podcast, Matthew, you headed up to Newcastle recently to meet Mary Midgley. What was the reason for your trip? What took you up to Tyne and Wear?
Well, I mean, I think her books are very interesting, but her career is a really astonishing one. I mean, she retired in 1980... at the age of 60, I think, and she'd only written one book by then, and so, you know, that might have been it. Plenty of academics have only written, of her generation, only wrote one book over the whole career, but she's just kept on observing the world and the way philosophers and others talk about it, and still feels there's lots of stupidity and loose thinking out there, and has just continued writing. And I think this is her 16th book. And she's still going strong, and I think every time she finishes a book, she slightly thinks it might be the last one, and then she reads something somewhere in the papers or in, you know, an academic journal and gets sufficiently irritated or even outraged by it and, you know, launches a counterblast.
She picks her enemies, doesn't she? Richard Dawkins is mentioned. This particular book, I think, was inspired by, was it Francis Crick?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think it's the whole reduction of psychology to biology, what she calls scientism, the sort of worship of science and the way of talking about human beings, which isn't very interested in our inner lives, our emotional lives, and so on. I would say these are kind of core themes that she's been reflecting on for many years.
Mm-hmm. And none of this has appeared in Wikipedia first.
Yes. Maybe on there shortly. Yes. Very good. That's page 46 this week. That's all for this week's issue review podcast. We do have a second podcast this week as well. I met with Morton Shapiro, president of Northwestern University, in a cafe around the corner, and our chat is up online in the same place as you found this podcast. You'll find us on all the articles we discussed today at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can join the conversation by searching for us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Google Plus as well. But until next week, that's the end of this week's issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.